Welcome to After Hours Live with Chuck Bowser RCDD, where you get to ask your favorite RCDD questions of. About cable installation, cable certification, cable estimation, cable project management, career path questions, certification questions. I forget to mention that one quite often, but I do certification questions all the time. So I appreciate everybody being here tonight. I'm broadcasting live on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. Trying to figure out how to get my Restream service to do it also to Instagram as well. Still trying to hack that one out. If you have a know how to do that, get in touch with me. Help a brother out, would you? Because it really needs to be done. The first one comes from Henry via an email. Henry says, what does future-proofing look like in cabling? Future-proofing. What does future-proofing look like in cabling? Oh, some systems are going to be there in February. Make sure you keep up. See if I'm coming, okay? Future-proofing, what does that actually mean, right? So future-proofing is basically making something so it's less likely to become obsolete. Less likely to become obsolete. Now, let's, for example, since Mark brought up wireless access points, let's use that as an example. Wireless access point. Now, for those who may not know what a wireless access point, it's a thing that you put in the ceiling, you connect it with cabling back to the network, and it broadcasts signal out over a Wi-Fi signal. So your phones and your computers and anything that's Wi-Fi enabled can actually get on the network, right? However, that wireless access point needs a cable. Why is it called wireless, Chuck? If it's a wireless access point, it needs cabling, right? Now, a lot of people don't know this, but when you look at network equipment, like hubs, routers, switches, right? Those kinds of devices, they have a lifespan of about 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years. Now, they don't just all of a sudden go bad. I mean, if you power one up and you use it and you'll never increase or do it, change anything, it'll last for a long time. I saw a picture today on TikTok of a comm closet somewhere that it was so old that when he opened up the door, there was a bunch of dust inside of it. Yeah, a bunch of dust. So, but anyways, so what happens is what makes network equipment, need to be replaced in 3 to 5 years? There's some new operating system comes out, right? Some new option that they can put out now that they couldn't put out before. Some new chips, a new processor. So because of that, you know, everybody always wants the latest and greatest computers, the latest, greatest watches, the latest, greatest phones, the latest and greatest wireless access points, right? Now, the average lifespan of a structured cable plant is, 10 years or more, 10 years or more. So what does that mean? That means that cable plant could likely see three changes of equipment, So think about that, right? Because again, the lifespan of a cable plant is 10 years. Network equipment's 3 to 5 years. So what kind of cable should you run to that wireless access point? Did you know a wireless access point will run on Cat5e? It will. Doesn't give you a lot of bandwidth, right? It can even run on Cat6, but Cat6a is the better choice there. Cat6A is the better choice. And I can hear, but Chuck, that's do it. We'll never have 10 gig going to a wireless access point. Today you won't. But what about the next generation of Wi-Fi, the next generation WAP, right? Because let me ask you a question and answer this in the chat box, right? Which is easier, to replace a wireless access point or to replace a cable, right? Now, you're probably thinking, well, Chuck, why not Cat7? Why not Cat7a? Why not Cat8? Well, first off, Cat7 and Cat7a, those are ISO cables, right? Used a lot in Europe, right? It's very good. Somebody else says AP. A wireless access point is sometimes called an AP. Very good. 10,000 points to you, Mr. George Humphrey. Welcome in, my friend. So predominantly used over in the ISO territories like Europe. And Cat8 can only go 30 meters, about 98 feet. And when you get into the Cat 7 and the Cat 7A and the Cat 8, now you really got to balance cost versus performance. Cost versus performance. Because when you get into the Cat 7, the Cat 7A, and the Cat 8, that cable is not cheap. Not cheap. Okay? And neither are the connectors. And because of the shielding inside of them, they are a pain in the neck to terminate and takes more time. And what is time to us? Time is money, right? So Cat 7 and Cat 7A, Cat 8, probably not the best choices when it comes to doing access points or wireless access points. Question number two. This one comes from Sherry via Instagram. Oh, you want to think, I want to point out one thing real quick. I know in the past I've told you if you have questions, submit them to me. But I'm getting questions coming in through email and TikTok and YouTube and stuff. And I've lost track of them. Some of the questions for today are actually a couple weeks old because I saw them. Oh, that's a question. I know I got to get better at that. I understand. I understand 100%. But from now on, send your questions to questions@letstalkcabling.com. That way they're all in one spot. Okay, all in one spot. So anyway, Sherry, Instagram, she says to me, I sat in a class recently, and they said that a Mutoa has to be at least 49 feet away from the telecom room. Why is that? That's actually, that 49-foot thing is found in the TDMM. So it says that Mutoa's got to be at least 49 feet away from the horizontal cross-connect, the patch panel, the 110 block, the Bix blocks for my Canadian folks, right? So it's got to be 15 meters or 49 feet. And the reason for that is when you start getting out past that 49 feet, it's going to minimize the effects that you're going to find from multiple connections that are in close proximity to that connection point. For example, it's going to reduce near and crosstalk and return loss issues. Right. So for those who may not know what return loss is, when a return loss is caused from a difference of characteristic impedance. So the characteristic impedance of four pair cable is 100 ohms. But by the way, it's plus or minus 5%. So this might be 99 ohms. The connector, which I don't happen to have one sitting in front of me, is also rated to 100 ohms, plus or minus 5%. But it might actually be at 101 ohms. That little bit of a difference causes some of the energy to get reflected. So the transmitter sends the signal down. It hits that mismatch of characteristic impedance. Some of the energy goes back, okay? Now, because that cable is less than 49 feet, that signal will be so strong, it's going to cause problems with the network equipment. That's why it's going to be at least 49 feet away from that. 49 feet. And because when you get further than 49 feet, then the effects of insertion loss start to weaken that signal so that way it doesn't have as much of a problem. Again, that strong signal is going to interfere with your electronics. The next question, this one comes from, I think it was from Low Volt Warby. Low Volt, if you're watching tonight or if you see this video later on, let me know if this is your question, right? So it basically said, the question was, what is a best practice when pulling cables through J-hooks? What is a best practice for pulling cables through J-hooks? The best practice I can give you, don't pull cables through J-hooks. You're not supposed to. You're supposed to pull cables, and when you're done, then lift them up and put them in the J-hooks, okay? If you pull cables through J-hooks, what happens is when that head of that cable that you're pulling hits the J-hook, it wants to bring the J-hook with it, which wants to bring the wire, which is going to damage the ceiling grid. It's going to cause you problems. It's going to cause that ceiling contractor to start uttering the words, backcharge, backcharge, yeah. If you know what that means, look it up, right? That means they're going to charge you to fix something, right? So you really shouldn't be pulling through J-hooks. But let's be honest. Raise your hand if you've ever pulled a cable through a J-hook. Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, a lot of people have. A lot of people have, right? So let's talk about some things you can do to help lower issues when pulling cables through J-hooks, if you end up doing it that way. The first thing is when you have a bundle of cables, when you stage them, you want to stagger the heads, okay? Stagger the ends, just like that. See, I'll do it here so that my TikTok peeps can see it. See, that's all staggered, right? Then once you got that staggered, then you want to put on your pull string. Now, the pull string that you're going to, the knot that you want to use is called a half hitch. You take that string, you flip it into a loop, and then you put the cable through that. Where's my other piece of cable that I got right here? Put the cable through that, and now when you tighten this down, it's actually going to bite on that cable, okay? So do at least two of those, at least two half hitches. And then you're going to want to tape it up. Now, when you go tape it up, you want to start at this end, okay? And this end here, so for my TikTok peep, so you can see it. And then you're going to basically take the tape and wrap it around it, go over your half hitch, keep going up, go over the second half hitch, and notice how it's got a nice, slim, tapered end. And then boom. See, that will probably not catch on anything in the ceiling. Now, when you get to the very, very end, because of that, you got that one single cable there, take the tape, go past it, come back, go past it, come back. Do that like three times, four times. And though, oh, by the way, and when you get done, leave a little tab on that tape. Okay. Leave a little tab on the tape. That way it makes it easy for the person on the other end. Just all they can do is grab that tab and then unwrap it. Okay. Or what a lot of detectives will do is they'll just go ahead and cut off the cables because their numbers will be behind that. Make sure you leave that tab. And then also make sure that you don't do anything like this here, right? So I'll hold this up so you can see it. You notice there's a spot there where you can see the cable jacket coming through, right? Where you can see the cable jacket come through. So the end of the cable is right there by the edge of my finger. That could catch something in the ceiling, especially if you got a really tight opening and tear it up. So you don't want to have any openings at all. When you wrap that tape around, you want about half of it covering over the previous layer and just kind of work your way up. Don't worry. Tape is cheap. Tape is cheap, right? What's not cheap is labor to go and open up another tile or cut open a ceiling to try to figure out where that cable had stuck. What is expensive is when it hit that J-hook and now the J-hook has bent the wire and has messed up the ceiling grid. Okay, so make sure you do a good job taping it. Here's some other tips when putting in J-hooks. Number one, you got to attach it to your own independent wire. You can't attach a J-hook to a ceiling grid wire. That is a code violation. Now, you have to identify your wires when you install them. So you can paint them. Invent sells a little clip on there that you could snap onto the T-bar, and then you can attach your wire to that. Another tip is to initially try to keep your cables in your J-hooks to 50 or less. 50 cables or less. I know they make bigger J-hooks. I know they do. But the problem is if you put more than 50 cables in a J-hook, the cables on the bottom of that J-hook will get crushed. Okay. Now, if you're putting in J-hooks for Category 5E or Category 6, make sure that you do them at random distances and you don't exceed 5 feet. Okay. Don't exceed 5 feet at random distances. If you put them exact distances, what's going to happen is you'll start getting this thing called harmonic disruption. Yeah. So when you have a cable gets crushed, let's say, for example, every 4 feet, that equates to a certain frequency. I talked about it before. Cat 6A cabling, put your J-hooks 3 to 4 feet apart at random distances. Now, the reason the Cat 6A J-hooks have to come closer together, they weigh more than the Cat 6A cable generally weighs more than Category 5E. 1,000 feet of 5E can weigh, 19 pounds or so. Cat 6A, some Cat 6As can weigh up to 40 pounds. Because, remember, they're 23 gauge, so they're bigger conductors. They got the cross-web separators inside of them, right? They got all kinds of things going on with them. That all adds weight. All adds weight. Question number four, and this comes from Karthiki from YouTube, and he wants to know, or she, I don't know which it is, why should a wireless access point not be connected at a Mutoa, only be directly connected to the horizontal cross connect in the telecom room? Can't we consider a wireless access point work area equipment? The answer is no. Live Old Warby, hey, did you send me the question about the J-hooks? Because if you did, I just literally answered it. I just answered with product demonstration and everything. So you might have to watch the recording, buddy. Right. So here's what the problem is. First, a Mutoa. It stands for a multi-user telecommunications outlet assembly. It's a faceplate or a small patch panel mounted on permanent building structure right next to a cluster of furniture. And then the customer will run patch cords from that Mutoa through the work surface and plug them into their devices. Now, if you put the wireless access point at the work area, some things can happen. it's now sitting on somebody's desk or sitting on the floor, right? Well, the first thing that can happen is it's not very secure. It's not very secure. Things can happen to it. It can be accidentally disconnected because the cleaning lady wanted to use the receptacle for the vacuum cleaner, right? And here's another thing. It's going to affect the performance because it's down low now. It's at the desk or it's on the ground. You want that wireless access point up high where it has clean, obstruction-free so it can broadcast out. So, no, you should not put it at the Mutoa, right? This question comes from user XX2NN2SN7V. How'd you come up with that name? Just out of curiosity, right? They want to know, Chuck, can you provide some Revit training videos on low voltage design? Maybe inviting an expert to come on the show and do their screens. Now, for those who may not know what Revit is, you probably already know what AutoCAD is, right? You blueprints, right? When you look at blueprints, they're made in AutoCAD. That's a one-dimensional drawing, shows you where the walls are and where your drops are going to be. Revit is a 3D version of AutoCAD, right? It's a 3D version to AutoCAD. And the beautiful thing about Revit is, if everybody from the job site makes a Revit file and then the GC combines them, you can actually open up the Revit file and look at the, for example, like the telecom room, and you can see if there's going to be a conflict with the lights and your ladder tray, right? Now, Revit's not easy to use. Somebody, I can see my sound there. Revit is not Revit. Yeah, it's a database. It actually is a database. Yes, very good. But you can be also combined and show out 3D renderings, right? Now, I did a show on Revit about 9 months ago. I can't remember the individual's name who came on. I did the show with. Maybe I'll ask them and have them come on and do some things. So, yeah, Revit can also be considered BIM modeling. Yes. Question number 6, and this one comes from an email from one of the people in my email group. If you're not on my email list, go to the website, join my email list, okay? Join the email list, because sometimes I send out special broadcasts only to my email subscribers, right? Offering free things sometimes. Anyways, CD sent me an email and it says, I was watching your series on fire stopping, and I have a question that I couldn't find the answer for. For a 4-inch diameter floor penetration, whether it's precast or sleeve, what is the minimum height that should come up above the floor? Now, I'm not aware of anything in the code book that says it's got to come up a certain distances, but the Telecom Distributions Methods Manual, the TDMM, tells us 3 inches. It's got to come above the floor by 3 inches. And the reason it's got to come above the floor by 3 inches is because when the fire, let's say you're in a multi-story building, a fire breaks out on the 5th floor, okay? Fire department shows up, the hose team goes up, they attach the standpipes, and they squirt out the fire with water. Now you got a bunch of water sitting on the floor. If that fire stop was cut flush with the floor, all that water is going to go down to the 4th floor and damage the 4th floor, right? It's to protect the floors below from standing water issues. So that's why it's got to be that 3 inches. Question number 7, this one comes from Hassan Alawasi. I hope I said your name right, Hassan. Now, this is one of those perfect examples. Hassan sent me this question about 2 weeks ago. And I saw it, but I was in the middle of doing something else. I was like, oh, yeah, I got to go back and ask that question. Well, it was about a week before I get back to it. And Hassan deleted the question because it sat there for a while. But I was able to luckily get it back looking in my deleted comments thing on my YouTube studio thing. And I found it. And then I shot him a response. Now, his question is, can you make a video on how to calculate BTUs for a telecom room or equipment room? Okay. BTU is British. There's another acronym for you. BTU, British Thermal Unit. A BTU is defined as how long it takes to heat a gallon of water. Is it 1 degree or 10 degrees? I don't know where it is. I don't remember off the top of my head. So it's just the way you measure heat, right? And he says, the TDMM says just to multiply the wattage by, I have here in my notes, 3.312, but actually I think it's 3.412. I think it's 3.412. Now, this is a great question, an absolute great question, because heat affects the performance of the cable, it affects the lifespan of the equipment, and it affects how you work in the telecom room, because you're all hot and sweaty, you're not going to be working as fast. But I will be the first to tell you, I've never calculated BTUs. 40 years in this industry, I've never calculated it. Never had to. So I reached out to one of my subject matter experts. That's the beautiful thing about being in this industry, is you know people, because you can't know everything about this industry. So I reached out to one of my subject matter experts. You might know him. He's been on the show a few times. His name is Tim Coleman. He's a PE and an RCDD. He's been on the show a few times. He's really good with codes. And he wrote a detailed explanation. So I'm going to read his explanation, because there's no way I could say this and look, you know, like I know what I'm talking about. So this is Tim Coleman's words. Okay. Tim Coleman's words. He says, our equipment does not do work. Any energy that enters into a switch is converted to heat. The issue is how much heat and where that heat is going to be dissipated. Before the days of PoE equipment, we could assume that all the heat was dissipated in the telecom room. The heat from the data signal itself is negligible, and you can consider that any data leaving a network switch is equal to the data being received by the network switch. For the ease of calculating this, let's assume that the outgoing data and incoming data cancel each other out. These items do not need to be considered for calculating heat from the equipment. Now, what is the actual power? What is actual power is a network switch using. Nameplate is the maximum power unit a power supply can provide, but it's not the actual power. The maximum power is not achieved unless all the ports on the switch are active with data and all the PoE ports are pushing their maximum power. This is rarely the case. Either with an onboard system monitoring or with an amp clamp on the hot side of the power cable, the actual power can be measured. Equipment with multiple power supplies and load sharing power supplies complicates this. In load sharing mode, the power supply may only be 25%, providing 25% of its name's plate rating. What is the PoE loading of each switch? The power provided by the switch for the PoE is mostly dissipated outside of the room by the PoE device. So we can consider the PoE power dissipated by the cable in the TR as also being negligible. Now, what he actually says, and this is the important part, what the build-out of the equipment on day one for that room, the telecom room, versus the full build-out. We rarely design a telecom room just for the capacity of the network equipment. We always design extra power for circuits added to the equipment. Future PoE devices, the DAS, which will be provided by another vendor, and so on. The heat load from the TRCs on day one is not what it's going to see 5 years after the building's done. But think about that. When you go into a telecom, they always, every time they add more stuff, and the more stuff they add, the more heat it's going to be, right? There's a minimum tool set that's installed to get the factory running over time. The factory adds more equipment. He's just giving an example there. It's not going to be the same from day one as it is through multiple days, right? Multiple days. Just it won't be. So, yeah, you can use that 3.4 number. But remember, it's, you know, you've got to look at a lot of things. You got to look at where that heat's coming out at, what's going to be the load over the long period of time, right? Let me see what Michael says here. He says, so here in Toronto, PoE blinds are really growing in demand. Are you familiar with any training or leading vendors with the PoE blinds? I'm not, but I will research that for you. Okay. PoE blinds. I may reach out to you on LinkedIn, Michael, since I know you and I are friends, to get some more information so I can get you an answer for that. Right. Let me see here. This is Corey. Hey, how you doing, Corey? Corey is a, him and I used to work together at Hinkles and McCoy a long, long time ago. Good stuff. Chuck reminds me of class. Reminds me of class grade. Thank you, Corey. I appreciate that, my friend. And then you have 13 Serpents. What do you suggest when you have to pull cabling in a freezing environment temperatures? Oh, that's a great question, 13 Serpents. Here's the thing. When a cable becomes cold, the jacket becomes brittle. And so when you go through J-hooks and you go through turns, the jacket cracks and it can flake and fall off. So most of the cable manufacturers will give you operating temperatures for which to pull the cable in. All right. And it varies by manufacturer. It does. And I realized, for example, one of them happened to know off the top of my head, it says 50 degrees. Well, you know what? I pulled cable in a building in the middle of winter that didn't even have the exterior walls up yet. So we're pulling cable and it's so cold outside that you can literally look outside because the outside walls in the building haven't been there yet. So there's going to be times where you might have to pull cable in freezing temperatures. So here's my suggestions. Okay. And it kind of depends on the environment. So the first suggestion is, if you're on a new construction site, like the one I just described, find a spot somewhere and get one of those portable propane heaters and have them blowing on the cables overnight. Keep them those cables up to temperature. And then pull them out and immediately install them. And then they'll start to cool down. Once they cool down, they're already in place. If you're doing cabling in an environment like, say, a meat locker, right? Just make sure that when you start, the cables are above temperature. So make sure they're out in the truck in the sun, keeping nice and warm. That way, while you're pulling them in that meat locker, they're still nice and warm. They don't cool down until after they're already in final place. Does that answer your question, 13 Serpents? I hope it does, my friend. So we're already at 6:30-something. We're already past my 30-minute mark. So until next time, everybody. One more thing before we go. Next Thursday, I'm going to do something special. I'm going to do a live after-hours stream like normal, but I'm going to put out a link. And if you want to join the show, you can actually hop on the link and join the show with me. How cool is that? Something new. I'm going to try something new. I might regret it later. I might not. I really like it and it helps the show a lot. We'll continue on with that. So make sure you attend next Thursday's show. Right? Till next time, everybody. Remember, knowledge is power.
That's it for this episode of today's podcast. We hope you were able to learn something. Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on future content. Also, leave a rating so we can help even more people learn about telecommunications. Until next time, be safe.